Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, and on our podcast today we have with us a very special guest, Dr. Mauricio Alcocer, professor of plant biology at the Autonomous University of Guadalajara in Mexico, who is also a signer of our Scientific Descent from Darwinism list. Dr. Alcocer, thank you so much for being on the podcast with us today.
It's my pleasure, Casey.
I think that your background will be very interesting to our listeners, especially since you are obviously a member of the international scientific community outside of the U.S. who is a signer of our Descent from Darwinism list. Obviously, you're not affiliated with Discovery Institute. You are a professor at the Autonomous University of Guadalajara, and yet you have doubts about Darwin. So I was wondering if you could share with our listeners a little bit about why do you have scientific doubts about the modern theory of evolution?
Well, in order for a theory to be fully accepted as Darwinian evolution has been accepted, you need the evidence that backs up the theory. And the problem is that Darwinian evolution as a theory is lacking very important evidence, especially evidence that shows that there has been a gradual progression of change let's say, on the whole organism or even in the organ level. We don't have the fossil records that show that gradual change in going from one species into another. That's one of the problems with Darwinian evolution. Another one is that we have very complex mechanisms working within the cell that would be very comparable to the complexity of a city or an airport, where things are coming and going, and they're coming and going in an organized manner, and with several interlocking mechanisms that, if you take one of those mechanisms by themselves, you need several parts for that mechanism to work, and it's very hard for evolution to explain how a mechanism as simple as a flagellum, a bacterial flagellum that has more than 40 different working pieces, how all of these working pieces evolved together to form the bacterial flagellum. And just like the bacterial flagellum, you can find many other mechanisms in the plant cell as well as in animal cells that have this level of complexity.
Now, what do you think of the Darwinist common objection to irreducible complexity, as you were just describing it, that obviously, you know, if one part of the flagellum was available to be borrowed or co-opted from some other system, that, you know, well, that can explain that this could evolve in a step-by-step fashion. Does that satisfy you as a biologist?
Well, no, because co-option means that organelle had to have existed previously in another cell in another organism, and what happened according to this point of view is that according to co-option is that it took that organelle from the other organism and made it its own. It's like going out when you're in your tool shed and you find that you need some tools. You go to your neighbor and you ask for a specific tool or a wrench or something because you needed to finish working on whatever project you have. That's the idea of co-option. But the thing is that with co-option, that organelle already existed. Where did it come from? And one, and two, that it requires forethought. You need to have a plan where you're thinking of where you're going to put that organelle. And that goes against Darwinian evolution, because Darwinian evolution is totally blind and purposeless. It's mind-boggling to think how purposeless evolution could end up with such a complex life as we find on the planet Earth.
Well, that's very, very interesting, Dr. Alcocer. We appreciate your perspective, your scientific perspective on these questions, because these obviously come up a lot in the debate over evolution. One thing I'd also like our listeners to hear from you about is you got your PhD from the University of Idaho in plant biology. Is that correct?
Yes, more specifically in plant science. And it was in the University of Idaho.
And I understand that one of the things that you studied in your PhD thesis was actually how plants can evolve resistance to herbicides. And herbicide or pesticide or antibiotic resistance is obviously something that Darwinists will very commonly cite as evidence for evolution. And I'm sure you would probably agree that that is a type of evolution. Is that kind of evolution, though, are we looking at a degree of evolution in this herbicide resistance or this kind of resistance that really helps explain how many of the features that we see in the biological realm could have evolved?
This is a very small change in one protein within the plant that change in the protein prevents the herbicide from locking onto that site, and so it becomes resistant. But this is a mutation. This is a naturally occurring mutation within the plant population of prickly lettuce. And what the herbicide was doing is that it was selecting for this mutation, which is part of what Darwin says. But selecting for a mutation in a protein is very different from, it's a large step going from that to saying that all of the life on our planet has resulted because of those blind, purposeless mutations. I think, a pretty fantastic story from a biologist's point of view.
Wow, that's quite compelling, Dr. Alcocer. Now, one thing that is commonly raised in the issue of resistance mutations is the idea of the fitness cost. Could you explain to our listeners, what is a fitness cost?
Sure. When a plant or any organism suffers a mutation, that mutation makes that plant or animal less efficient in what it's doing. Well, precisely because there's a change in the configuration of the molecule, and that loss of efficiency makes that plant or that organism less efficient than an organism who does not have that mutation. According to this fitness theory, a less fit organism will naturally die away from the population. That's what fitness is all
sure.
about.
So the fitness cost basically comes in when a mutation occurs, it allows a population, maybe it's plants, maybe it's insects, maybe it's bacteria, they can become resistant to a toxin that's trying to kill them.
Right.
But then what ends up happening is, but when you try to have this resistant population then compete with the original population that didn't have this mutation, the resistant population actually tends to be less fit. And so does this imply that maybe mutations, you know, in some instances, they may confer a benefit in some special circumstances, but overall, they actually may tend to mess things up.
Yeah, that's true. In the particular case where I studied prickly lettuce, we saw that there wasn't much of a change in fitness between the resistant and the susceptible. But in plants that are resistant to, for example, triazine herbicides, which inhibit the photosynthesis in a plant, they are much less fit. They're smaller, they grow slower, and they can't compete as well against the susceptible biotypes.
So fitness cots, they might not always be there, but actually the fact that they are so common is precisely what allows us to actually rely upon the fact that there are limits to evolution that allow us to use these pesticides, these herbicides, these insecticides, antibiotics, and so forth. We rely on the fact that there are limits to evolution, and that is what enables the resistant strains to actually not perform as well, and they will not proliferate over the non-resistant strains that are killed by the pest-killing strategy.
Exactly. That's exactly the case. For example, there's sickle cell anemia, which is a mutation in the way that hemoglobin is made in the blood. It's very detrimental to the person who has sickle cell anemia, but it helps that person survive malaria. But again, it comes at a tremendous cost to the person who has sickle cell anemia.
I just find this very interesting, Dr. Alcocer, because it seems like this common example of evolution that we always hear from the Darwinian community as proof that, you know, that evolution can produce, you know, anything, essentially. The reality is that these pest-fighting strategies rely upon the fact that there are limits to evolution in order for them to succeed, and really they demonstrate perhaps precisely the opposite point that that many Darwinists were hoping they would demonstrate.
Yes, of course. There are very few cases where you can find that a mutation has been beneficial to an organism. Usually it isn't. It helps it get over the present problem, but once that problem or that selection pressure is out of the picture, the population goes back to the normal susceptible type.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Mauricio Alcocer, we really appreciate your time and being on the podcast with us today. And thank you also for being willing to stand up and sign the Dissent from Darwinism list. One question I'd like to end with. Obviously, here in the United States, many of our listeners are familiar with the fact that we had many scientists on this podcast before who have experienced persecution because of their views, that they dissented from Darwinian evolution. And this is a very real phenomenon, unfortunately, here in the United States. I don't know if you personally have experienced anything negative. Obviously, you might be in a university where there's more freedom. But overall, what I would like to ask you is, in the scientific community outside of the U.S., in Mexico, for example, is it difficult for a scientist to stand up and question the predominant Darwinian paradigm and still feel secure that he or she is going to be as secure in their career as they were before they stood up and made that statement?
You can't say that, for example, in a public university in Mexico, because, as you say, Darwinian evolution is taught as if it were a law, just like Newton's law of gravity. Nobody even thinks of questioning it, which is quite sad. But there are more and more scientists who are beginning to open up their eyes and finding out that Darwinian evolution has a lot of holes that do not explain life as it is. And so, as I say, more and more scientists are opening up their eyes to that fact.
Well, Dr. Alcocer, we really appreciate your time, and thank you so much for being on the podcast with us today.
It was my pleasure, Casey.
This is Casey Luskin here with the ID the Future podcast. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.